Welcome to the Climate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Grove. Today, we're going to talk about climate education. I know we've talked about climate education before. Specifically, we've discussed how to teach children about climate, and we've talked about climate programs in higher education. But all of these programs need teachers who understand and are willing to add climate to their curriculum. How do we teach teachers to teach climate? And how do we form the networks needed to support both formal and non-formal climate education? We're joined today on Zoom by Marie Fargo, Senior Climate Change Instructional Resources Coordinator for Climate Generation. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Bob. Nice to be here.
Amy Frame is the Director of Strategic Partnerships for 10 Strands. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Bob. Hi, everybody.
Barbara Martinez Guerrero is the Executive Director of Dream and Green.
Awesome.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Bob. Great to be here with everyone.
And Seth Spencer, Team Climate Network Coordinator for Climate Generation. Hi, Seth.
Hi, everyone.
Seth, let's just start with you. What are the challenges that educators face when they try to incorporate climate content into their curriculums?
Yeah, well, we've all kind of heard that educators are facing a lot of challenges on just being able to be a teacher, but specifically with climate change, I think one of the biggest ones is just a little bit of maybe discomfort in their own knowledge of a pretty complex topic. And so I think many educators come in, they like, okay, I sort of understand what climate does, but this climate change thing, there's so much data out there, there's so much complexity that they get a little fearful possibly of even bringing that information to their students. And I think also just depending on the region that they're teaching it throughout the country or throughout North America, there can be difficult challenges of how to make it relevant and local. And that's a big thing of why I'm here is to support educators in taking this huge idea that's impacting everywhere around the world, but making it locally important and relevant to the teacher and then the student and hopefully the rest of the community.
Barbara, what kind of challenges do you see for climate educators?
I think some of the challenges that are being faced by educators is knowing how to integrate it into specific disciplines. Sometimes teachers feel that climate education should be done just in the science classes. And so I think there is kind of a, not misinformation, but kind of a hesitancy to integrate things about, sea level rise or extreme heat, because that's seen as very scientific or, only to be done in like an environmental science class. But I think that, is the big challenge for some teachers. They'll often say, well, I'm a history teacher, I'm very limited on what I could teach, or I teach art with my students. How can I integrate climate education into my curriculum? And I think the second thing is a lot of the times, depending on the school district that you are under, there are very specific curriculum that you need to follow. I know that in Miami-Dade County, there's pacing guides so that teachers know exactly what they're supposed to be teaching when. And so that leaves very little room for anything else. And so if it's seen as something extra, then sometimes there is that, like I said, hesitation to try something new or to integrate it.
Yeah. And you mentioned policy, school boards and such like that. It does regrettably seem that climate change is something of a political football, which I think places more challenges to the teachers. Amy, what are your thoughts on teachers and challenges?
Well, I think a lot of the challenges are built right into the system because teachers from the beginning in their pre-service training don't have climate literacy elevated to the top of the list of the millions of things that they need to do. And then in most cases, there isn't systemic training for in-service teachers or non-formal educators to really take the time to focus on this and learn enough about it to get confidence to actually integrate it. And I'd say, in addition to that, there are actually a ton of great resources, but teachers lack the confidence to sort of cull through those on their own in a lot of cases. And then on the other end of it, there's really no accountability for doing it. So if teachers have the option of teaching something safe or something that 50-50 could be a problem, they're going to, you know, opt for what is safer for them. And I think part of that is because when they look around their school sites, for the most part, they're not seeing decarbonization efforts going on. They're not seeing that the climate crisis is being taken into consideration in facilities planning and other policies related to procurement and, you know, campus grounds and all of those different things that actually have a huge impact on the actual like ecosystem resilience and climate adaptation and mitigation in a certain community. Just those things.
just that, right? I'm hearing a lot of comments on climate literacy. I mean, how do the teachers learn about that? I'm also hearing that there's not that network to support them. Marie, what are the challenges you see?
Sure. I mean, I would agree with what was said. Those are all really great. Just to add on, I hear a lot from educators that they just need more time. So for the educators who maybe are talking about climate change in their classrooms, they want to go that extra step and do climate action projects with their students, like building garden beds or, you know, getting a composting system started in their cafeteria. But just having the time to coordinate those efforts can be really challenging within a school day or beyond. And so really a need for kind of external partners or support or volunteers who can help them with that space. I think another challenge I've heard from educators is just a concern about bringing too much gloom and doom or the anxiety that their students might feel when they talk about climate change. And so that can sometimes prevent them from wanting to broach the topic with their students. And so that's something we work at Climate Generation as well, is talking about climate anxiety and how to cope with that.
I was going to say climate anxiety is a big issue. And also just understanding that, you know, it's not just so much the education of going in, but understanding how we live with climate change. I mean, well, obviously we want to help reverse it as much as we can, but it's here. We have to recognize that we can live with it. And there are strategies to live with that. Barbara, I mean, you brought up some good issues in terms of the different types of climate education and the different groups we need to work at. So how do we bring climate education to our next generation?
Well, I think we have to start young and we have to start integrating it into other disciplines. I think that there's a great opportunity to have a climate education be themed units where it integrates into all disciplines. So, you know, students read a book in language arts about the climate crisis, and then they do an art piece, and then they talk about the history, and then they do math problems related to that. And so when you start young and integrating those concepts and that knowledge and those terms, then I feel that it is more accessible as, you know, as students move on. You know, what we experience is by the time they get to high school, you know, the only class where they talk about climate change is if that student has an AP environmental science class. But if they have, if they choose another track and, you know, or for example, physics or forensic science, for example, then all of a sudden that environmental and climate piece is no longer there. And so we tend to be more open when it's elementary school to integrate all of those concepts together. But then I think we do not so good job at continuing that. And so I think that we need to take heed of what we do in elementary and somehow carry it over, you know, for the secondary students and teachers as well.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with what Barbara has just mentioned. And I would also add that teachers and schools in general, but teachers are kind of seen as trusted messengers of information most of the time. And right now, what a lot of students are getting is information from news media or social media. And so we kind of know that what might be even talked about might not be the most accurate information. And as Barbara said, trying to make sure that students are hearing about climate change and not necessarily that we're going to reach a certain temperature by 2030 or anything like that, but just talking about how our climate and our habitats are changing in early or elementary. And so that, yeah, by the time they're in middle school, they can go a little bit more in depth in some of those climate action projects. And they're in high school, they see themselves as engaged citizens that can kind of take that next step to really make sure that right now it seems very piecemeal of some of the both the education and the action, depending on what city or state or region you live in. And I think all of our organization's goals is that it's a national kind of movement, but also just that students are entering the world ready to kind of take on climate change and really react to it.
You've talked about how powerful teachers are to engaging students, but communities too. I mean, talk a little bit about teachers' importance with communities. Seth?
Yeah, going back to, I think, that trusted messenger. And we've unfortunately seen some of that maybe changing in news media that teachers are getting a little bit more pushback on what they should be teaching. But I think overall, teachers are still seen as folks that have a trust relationship with the student, which then goes home, hopefully, and connects to the family. And then it really spreads out there. And so our organization, I think all the organizations here really believe that when teachers feel knowledgeable and comfortable to talk about climate change throughout those disciplines, it then kind of spreads out of, oh, we're talking about how climate change is going to impact my park or my business, or we're talking about the school as like a living laboratory of what green energy really could be, as Barbara mentioned, how important that is. And that's been a big push of our organization, I think, in Minnesota as well, of really looking at that kind of green transition or green energy within schools. And there's been a lot of policy and money towards that, and we're really excited about that.
Amy, what kind of professional learning do teachers need to teach climate?
Well, I think that getting excited about the problem and knowing that there are partners to help address the problems locally is really important. Somehow schools just like got way behind the curve, right? Like insurance industries understand climate change is happening and it's real. Businesses understand, cities have plans. And so a lot of the work that we're trying to do is bring educators, especially at the County Office of Education level here in California, since they do these regional plans that address, you know, ecosystem issues in certain regions. These agencies, utility agencies, and other things like that have resources, and what they really have is local data. They have models about what's going on now, what's likely to go on in the future, given different scenarios. And I think that that's something that being grounded in that local data set really makes it real for educators, that this is something that's happening now, and that there's a whole community of people that are interested in and who literally have jobs and green careers in addressing these issues going forward. So we work with a lot of educational leaders at the regional level to convene community-based partner networks, which is meant really broadly. Those could be climate justice organizations, other kinds of environmental justice organizations, people that have a tiny little, you know, wildlife area that, you know, some students could walk to, really a really broad coalition of people that are there to say, teachers, like, here's the real thing that's happening here. Is this something that's interesting to you? And would your kids like to be involved in restoration or, you know, spreading the word or getting input from the community about, you know, plans for this area and that type of thing. So I think the profession, and then what those community-based partners really need to understand, as you were saying, Barbara, about things like pacing guides is, you know, the standards and the assessments are not going away. That's not the community's role to change those things. And here in California, our standards and our curriculum frameworks in social studies, science, history, health, even math do include climate change and environmental justice as part of what teachers are expected to teach. And we would really like our community-based partners to try to like connect with what teachers are already required to do and work within that system, rather than fighting against the fact that there are standards.
So Marie, you're a resources coordinator What kind of climate resources do teachers need?
Yeah, I think going back to what Barbara said, interdisciplinary resources are so key. I'm working with a number of elementary educators right now to design K-2 resources. So definitely at those early grade levels, we're not seeing a very high quantity of resources available yet, or educators haven't really built those out yet. And so we're really excited about the opportunity to kind of support that early learning in climate change.
Yeah, we're talking about formal education, the K through 12, colleges, universities, and such. What about the non-formal climate education? For instance, our sponsor, the Climate Council, is an educational nonprofit that provides climate networking, news feeds, podcasts to different areas of the country. How important are these types of community and collective actions? Seth?
I think they're vital. And the reason that they're so important right now is we just heard some of those barriers that formal K-12 educators are facing. Time, not meeting the standards, maybe a little pushback from school boards. And so where you might have a nonprofit or and some type of environmental education organization that has a little bit more flexibility of not necessarily meeting a school district mandate or a state education requirement, but meeting more national guidelines around what should be included in science education, but also social studies. And as we heard, connecting to those teachers is so key of A, building upon our community of, okay, yes, we have the school as a really important area, but we have these other partners that are right there and kind of ready. And I think that's an area that I've seen has kind of been unfortunately missed. We've seen as, oh, those non-formal folks are out there doing their thing and you might go to like a summer camp or an after-school program, but really coming together. And so that they're kind of building off of each other of maybe those non-formal partners are really where we should say, okay, in early education, you are the leader, and then we can get the school in there. But again, I think it's always about building upon what we do within our communities. And so it's not, as I said before, not so piecemealed of like one hero teacher that's doing great work in one middle school and kind of feels on an island of not really seeing anything else happen. Because we say, yes, interdisciplinary, but then you need multiple teachers to kind of be on board. And so maybe having a teacher be able to partner with some of those non-formal or informal educators is kind of a key step.
And I want to...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to build on that. just because, you know, as a non-formal educator, I feel like non-formal educators have more freedom. And so, and we have the ability to go out and find resources and go out and look for data and go out and find those partnerships. So in a way, we do a lot of heavy lifting for the teachers. And so when, you know, I was a formal educator, I was in the classroom for 12 years before moving on to nonprofit sector. But, you know, having that experience of being a teacher there, again, time is definitely something that is very restrictive. And so you don't have the time to read articles about, you know, what's happening, you know, and the data that's coming out. But nonprofits and non-formal educators do have a little bit more. And so I believe it's our responsibility to serve as, you know, that link between what teachers are supposed to be teaching in the classroom because it's in the textbook and what is happening in real time. And that's, I think, the benefit of those partnerships and those community partners.
Amy, you've mentioned that the K-12 system needs the support of community-based partners. Go ahead and tell us more about that.
I think equity is a huge issue in climate literacy in California. And we have lots of examples of strong partnerships between an individual teacher and a community-based partner, those teachers that always go on certain field trips or bring in certain guest speakers or do a civic engagement project. And those are awesome, and I don't want to do anything to take away from those. But what we also have is the majority of the students not getting anything like that. And so what we actually need is a systemic approach to making sure that every student at every grade level gets appropriate climate literacy or environmental literacy instruction to build up to those kinds of understandings that we need them to have to enter the workforce and be adults. And also, as we know, to make a difference as high school students and even younger in some cases. And so to that end, you know, 10 Strands has supported a partner portal where we're trying to get every single environmental education provider in the state to insert, you know, include their information, including whether they talk about climate change, and then work with our educators so that they can search for those things. But that's just the first step, because where the bang for the buck really comes is when a district takes on climate literacy as a thing. And this does happen usually in response to a board resolution that was usually started by students. So I work with a number of districts now that are like, oh my God, now we have to teach climate change and we don't know how to do it. And so they're working with gathering community-based partners to create a K-12 scope and sequence for what the right pieces and building blocks are at each level and who the right partners. And then to think about how to channel money to investing so that students throughout the entire district have those experiences. And it's not all just the fifth grade camping trip or the fourth grade beach cleanup, but that it continues into middle and high school and that it's thoughtfully sequenced through the grade levels. And that includes finding money for the professional development of the community-based organizations to work with those other grade levels of students and with students from every kind of school in the district, not just the ones that might usually come on those trips. So it's, yes, the partners existing and doing their thing, but it's building on that to make this a systematic experience for all of the students.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot about support systems, community networks, things like that. Marie, talk to us a little bit about cohorts. I mean, what's their role in bringing teachers together and providing this kind of support?
Sure. Well, at Climate Generation, we've started a cohort model, particularly around our Summer Institute for Climate Change Education, which we host every year. And the cohort work really helps us as an organization just based out of Minnesota, who can't possibly know everything about what's going on around the country. It helps us localize climate change to different regions and really connect educators to people who are doing high quality work in their actual region, and really highlight the solutions and the local community action that's taking place in those regions.
So do cohorts in general, is that a system that aids the educators? Barbara, what are your thoughts?
Well, going and building that support system, I think, is super important. I feel that sometimes we've talked about this, it's mentioned before, that sometimes you have like that one teacher at a school that decides to take it on. And what ends up happening sometimes is that they get overwhelmed if they're the only ones that continue to do things from year to year. And so a cohort gives that support system, helps a teacher figure out other teachers that are just as, you know, as passionate as they are, and exchange ideas, talk through challenges. And I feel like that is so important, especially with teachers that feel like they're not getting enough support from their administrators. And, you know, I totally agree with Amy that not every school gets the same, you know, information, resources, and motivation. And so I think by learning from each other through those cohorts really benefits and helps teachers to keep motivated.
I see the advantage of the localized cohorts, which is what I think we're talking about. Amy, what about national cohorts, international cohorts? Do they play a role?
Yeah, absolutely. I think having led the California cohort for the Climate Gen Summer Institute for the past 3 years, it I have really gotten a lot out of working with the other cohort leaders in their regions and understanding what it's like to take different versions of a regional approach to this work. So different parts of the US, but also outside of the country as well. And I guess one thing that it really helps with is reflection on the approach that we're taking in California and why we may have selected that. Because when you're in the middle of a system or, you know, a process, you sometimes like lose sight of other possibilities for creating change and for bringing people together. And so just getting to reflect and getting new ideas is really important. And honestly, for us too, you know, there was a time when California was really ahead of the curve on climate and environmental education, and that's not necessarily the case anymore. And although we have made a lot of progress, we have not been able to yet secure like funding for all of the implementation that we would really need to train all levels of the system to make these changes. And so just honestly, personally, for me, the slight bit of competition really helps motivate me to get California where it deserves to be as a world leader in environmental literacy and climate change education.
You're listening to The Climate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Grove. We're speaking with Amy Frame, Marie Fargo, Barbara Martinez-Guerrero, and Seth Spencer about climate education. So let's talk about the different groups you represent. Seth, tell us about Climate Generation, and specifically, I'd like to learn more about the Summer Institute for Climate Change.
Yeah, so Climate Generation is, I think, about an 18-year-old climate change education nonprofit that was co-founded first by Will Steger, who's a polar explorer and science educator from Minnesota. And Will, on his explorations, was seeing climate change firsthand, but knew that bringing that story of what was happening back was so important, and that teachers were really the change makers in their community. We've built off that legacy to really know that if we're going to do climate change education, we need to make sure teachers and educators in general are supported, but also that we need to build that into a larger kind of community approach, and that key, we're not leaving youth behind. And so we do have these, we've got a youth, a community, and education program now. And we have now been doing the Summer Institute for Climate Change Education for also, I think this will be our 18th year. And for the first 13, 14 years, it was pretty Minnesota or Midwest focused, which was, it was great. It was in person. And then in 2020, we had this world-changing event. We had the COVID pandemic. Our education team was like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? Do we just kind of give up? And they pivoted really well into a virtual space. But they realized in that virtual space that in order to be successful, they needed to have partnerships. And so we're now coming into the fifth year, really, of this partnership work with other climate change education and climate justice organizations that we call our cohort leaders that are really in charge of regional groups of teachers across North America to help us put on this 3-day virtual / hybrid institute for both formal and non-formal educators, early elementary all the way up through university. And pivoting to that virtual space allowed us to reach many more educators, make it a bit more equitable. And for the last 4 years, we've been reaching around 300 educators every summer. And as kind of Amy and Barbara and Maria all said, it's just such a great way for us to both expand the work that our organization wants to do, but be way more successful at actually localizing climate change impacts and mitigations in a way that we wouldn't be able to do if we were just going to host like a couple day in-person institute here in Minnesota.
Yeah, and you're talking about cohorts across the United States, but also in other countries, Canada and such.
Yeah. And so I would say, mostly been focusing on North America for our cohort partners. We have participants or educators attending the Summer Institute every year. Internationally, we're probably now at about 25 countries that have been represented over the last 5 years. Again, that virtual space was so key. but last year we had 18 regions or 18 cohorts represented by 23 different organizations that helped not only put on the Institute, but really come up with that planning process. What do educators need in our current environment? How does climate and environmental justice need to show up? How can we support students the best way possible? And it's really been the greatest work that I've been able to do as an educator.
Marie, can you talk about the Summer Institute's collective days?
Sure. So the Summer Institute begins with what we call two collective days. They're kind of what you think of when you think of a classic conference, right? So we have keynote speakers, concurrent sessions, and everyone is participating in the same types of events. And so for those 2 days, we invite presenters from all areas of climate change, climate justice, from youth activists to Indigenous leaders, somatic movement instructors, and so on, and as well as other educators, I should say. We love to have educators talking to other educators about teaching climate change. And so the participants at the Institute are able to choose different sessions based on their interests, their comfort level with climate change already, and areas that they'd like to grow in. Some of the collective day sessions are a little more theoretical and broad, just looking at, you know, what is climate justice, or, you know, looking at urban farming as a solution to climate change with your students. And then there are some that are a little more content focused. It'll be like a specific curriculum that educators can then bring back and use in their classrooms. So it's a fun way to bring kind of everyone together, get everyone engaged and excited. And that's kind of our building block or our foundation for those cohort days, where then educators go into their individualized groups led by those cohort leaders from different organizations and talk about more localized actions and solutions.
And this is all virtual?
Yes, the collective days are all virtual. So with the cohort days, it's optional, typically virtual, but some do choose to do it in person.
Amy, tell us about 10 Strands.
Well, 10 Strands is a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to strengthen the partnerships and strategies that will bring environmental literacy to all of California's K-12 students. So we're really focused on that age group, the K-12 students, but we work both within the formal system and the non-formal system in order to do that. And we also partner closely with the California Department of Education. So in the past, we have been supporters of getting climate literacy embedded into our state's frameworks and with science, with our science standards even, and our state's environmental literacy blueprint and model curriculum. In fact, one of our projects that's ongoing right now is the state has set aside $6 million for a climate change and environmental justice curriculum. And then we are managing that project to work with, I think, 12 different community-based partners and curriculum experts to create these very grounded and locally focused student-centered units that should be coming out soon. So we also host the California Environmental Literacy Initiative, which is this intersecting group of networks for county office and district and community partners, and really bring people together. And then within that, we fuel tons of, you know, different working groups and coalitions around everything from just like a sheer equity focus to green schools and climate resiliency in schools.
You mentioned you support state-funded climate change curriculum, but also an environmental justice curriculum. Touch on that environmental justice a little bit more.
Well, I think around 2020, when we not only had, you know, the pandemic, but we also had the racial reckoning, which I know was centered there in Minnesota, the two worlds of racial justice and environmental justice just came together to understand that there is a common cause and that it would be absurd to talk about one without talking about the other. And especially in a state with California, where you have such incredible disparities in pollution burdens, access to green space, as well as access to environmentally focused education or climate education, period. We knew that the units we created would need to connect those two. And so we really started with servicing environmental justice issues and solutions in different regions of the state to highlight by people working on the ground in those communities, and have built up our units around those specific case studies and examples, so that going back again to this idea of concrete data, right? Teachers need to understand what's really going on. It's really clear what's going on and what the causes are. And we really want to help the students unpack the information that we have about that and then feel empowered to do something about it in a way that will have an impact as well.
Barbara, tell us about Dreaming Green.
So Dreaming Green has been around not as long as Climate Generation, but almost there, 17 years. I didn't start the program. I'm just been with the organization for about 6 years. But our main mission is really to empower individuals to tackle climate change and other environmental issues at the local level. So we're based out of Miami, Florida, which, you know, a lot of people say it's ground zero for the climate crisis. You know, we are very vulnerable because we're so close to the sea and our you know, geographical makeup. And so our organization has a couple of different programs. Our biggest program relates to something that Amy just mentioned, green schools. And so our program is called the Green Schools Challenge. And through that program, we integrate environmental literacy lessons from pre-K through 12th grade in a holistic way. You know, Seth mentioned, you know, having schools being serve as like living laboratories of things that teachers and students can do to see an impact on the operations of the school, you know, energy efficiency, water conservation, recycling. There are a lot of projects that a school can take on to actually tackle the climate crisis. And so this big green school movement that's happening nationally, we promoted locally. We also have a program in which we go out into the community and try to engage with parents, with other community members. We focus on more rural communities. You know, Miami-Dade County is pretty large. Most people, when they think of Miami, they just think of like Miami Beach, which obviously it's great. But there's so many more areas. You know, we have a huge agricultural community. We have, you know, we have the Everglades on one side, a lot of natural areas. But then we have Miami Beach and City of Miami. I mean, we have about 2.7 million people in the county. So we do these workshops to try to reach more of the population on energy efficiency and water conservation in these communities. We do these in English and Spanish, you know, and Haitian Creole, which those are the, you know, Haitian Creole and Spanish are two of the other languages that are, you know, highly popular and spoken here. So we want to make sure we reach those populations as well. We do a lot of outreach and collaboration with not only other nonprofits, but also with our local government, municipalities, and the county itself. We're very happy now that we've actually, you know, Miami-Dade County is the third largest public school system in the country. And we now expanded to Broward County, which is the sixth largest, and Palm Beach County, which is the 10th largest. So there are a lot of students, you know, we're not as big as California, you know, LA, I know it's is number one school district in terms of students, but we definitely feel like it's important to try to reach all of the schools. We do it in a way where it's actually a competition format. So schools earn points for every lesson they do, every activity they organize that goes beyond the classroom, any event that they attend, workshops that teachers take part of. So a school basically accrues these points throughout. And then at the end of the year, we have an award ceremony and prizes go out and individual nominations. So we try to make it fun and exciting and engaging for the students and the teachers.
So Barbara, how has being part of Climate Gen's cohort coalition impacted Dreaming Green?
So we participated for the first time last year, and you know, for us, it is extremely valuable to learn from others because we are such a small organization. You know, our capacity to do a lot of things is very limited, and so by partnering with Climate Generation and going through the Summer Institute, we've been able to make additional connections to other organizations. And that has really been pivotal for us to make sure that our program continues to evolve. Even though we focus a lot on the local issues, we do want to be integrated into there is, you know, a lot more that can be done nationally, and how do you build up those coalitions? So the partnership has been great. I actually got a chance to participate in COP last year with Climate Generation. They have a program where they take representatives from various organizations to every year to COP. I'm not sure who went this year, but that was a great experience for me personally. And that's why, you know, I'm going to keep supporting whatever they do, because they know what they're doing.
Barbara, I mean, you've already, let's jump over to Amy. Amy, you've talked a little bit about your work with Cohort. You want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, I love hearing your perspective from a smaller organization, Barbara. Really, 10 Strands is a small organization too. And over the years, one of the things that we've been really trying to do is be more strategic about how to reach the number of students that we have. So, for example, at the most recent Summer Institute, we had folks from LAUSD Los Angeles Unified that has 400,000 students in it just in that one district. And because of some of the folks' participation in the Climate Gen cohort over the years, though, that is a group of folks who are on a climate literacy task force who have helped to push through a resolution in LAUSD where they now have, you know, a staff member assigned to dealing with just climate literacy. They're building out a website. They have regular meetings. They're part of our district climate literacy exchange where folks are trying to talk about that. And so I think that there are, you know, having that sort of third or outside space for folks, you know, may run into roadblocks within their own organization or district or region, but there are a lot of sort of collateral benefits and networking that comes to bringing people together just to focus on this one thing that we're so passionate about, which is climate education. And then also we have a lot of partners in things like the California Water Resources Board. They produced all of this great curriculum related to the drought and to a sustainable groundwater law that we have out here that folks need to implement, but they just really weren't sure how to get that to teachers or classrooms. And so by connecting folks with this, you know, hot off the presses curriculum based very strongly in, you know, science in the region, hydrological data and all of that kind of thing, and connecting them with an audience to pilot and give feedback and improve that, it's really strengthening the quality of education. We also worked with Save California Salmon on a traditional ecological knowledge curriculum that they recently put together, focused on water protection and climate change. And they were able to present, and they got lots more folks to come to their additional trainings and sessions from that. So I think being able to, and I'll say, you know, we have tons of intersecting networks and tons of resources, and everyone that I ask, because Climate Generation is such a great organization, every partner that I asked said yes, and they were thrilled to participate in it. And that is, you know, knowing that we would be able to gather up an audience for them to share about their work has been really valuable. And just in my role as Director of Strategic Partnerships, that's what excites me when we have people that are connecting over, you know, oh, I need resources and I have resources, boom, you know. it happens, and then being part of ongoing meetings and, you know, Zooms and collaborations after that. And so I think that's why it's also important to keep doing this year after year, because, you know, the Collaborative Day program gets better, my program gets better, and all of us get stronger. I think we've had a lot of people that have come like all of the years that it's been virtual, and I think they still will, because this is such a quickly evolving field.
Marie, you mentioned earlier, touched on the Midwest Cohort Day. You said that was a wonderful way for Climate Generation staff to actually learn from the teachers. How did the teachers impact Climate Generation?
Well, we get feedback all the time, is that, you know, educators are just so open to sharing their experiences and saying, you know, this is what's challenging, this is a barrier for me, and it really helps us better tailor, you know, how we build out our resources, where we're accessing our resources from, you know, how we're reaching our audiences and speaking to our audiences. So it's just so great to hear back from them, like what they need and what they're experiencing. Yeah, it's just been really, really valuable, really helpful.
Seth, I heard some discussion of COP, you know, the UN, you're sending delegations. I assume that you're making that information available to your broader network, you know, the Teach Climate Network cohort and such. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So Barbara was referring to the Conference of the Parties, which is the every year United Nations conference hosted in different countries to really bring national leaders to really make those international decisions, or at least agreements, on how to both reduce carbon emissions on an international level, but also what are we going to do now that climate change is happening? And so Climate Generation is just one of thousands of organizations that bring folks together to send what we call delegates to this year, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, in just over about 10 days from now, and really to interact with some of those national leaders, but also just to really support folks from around the world to really demand climate change action, make sure that climate justice is being discussed and being part of the discussion, and really bringing back these huge decisions, and again, making them local. And so this year, we have a Minnesota-focused delegation, and one kind of section, 1 week, is going to be just education-focused. And so we have some Minnesota-based formal educators that are going to be able to go over and bring both the needs and desires of their students to this international conversation, but really bring that experience back and be able to empower their students of, like, participating in something like this that you might not have ever heard of, but is so critical to this conversation. But also just like, what are some of those steps that you can take as an individual, but as a community, as a school, to really learn about climate change. But I think the key piece is take action of how do we reduce carbon emissions, but really how do we kind of adapt to what our new reality is going to be as our summers are getting warmer, winters are getting warmer, droughts, sea level rise, all of that, but still focus on hope and positivity and try to make sure we're not falling into that climate anxiety piece.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Where can our listeners go to learn more about your work, Seth?
Yeah, so we always love for folks to visit our website, which is ClimateGen, altogether climategen.org. And you can interact with all of our different programs there, and we'd love for you to reach out to us.
Barbara, where can people go to learn more about your work?
Well, definitely check out our website, dreamingreenaltogether.org, and there you'll find our mission, our impact, all of our programs, and ways to follow us on social media through our different platforms.
Amy, where would you like to send people to learn more about your work?
Please check out 10strands.org to find out about all of our various programming.
Thank you. And Marie, anything you want to add?
I'll just put in a plug for our resource library on Climate Generation's website. So again, you can go to climategen.org/resources.
Well, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about the Climate Council's educational programs or learn how to form a Climate Council chapter in your area, please visit their General Knowledge Center at climategkc.org. And as always, I'd like to thank our listeners. We welcome your questions and feedback. You can learn more about the Climate Hour at climatehour.net. That's climatehour.net. This is the Climate Hour. I'm your host, Bob Grove.